Welcome to Nosecast. Homilies delivered in the Holy Gnosis of Thomas Chapel, the Ecclesia Gnostica, in Salt Lake City, Utah, by the Reverend Troy Pierce.
Today we celebrate the Apostle of the Apostles, the foremost disciple, Mary of Magdala. We know so very little about an historical Mary. There are references to very few things. One is that she had demons that were exorcised. We assume that this is either was it done by Christ or by a disciple of Christ. And the number of the demons was a number of completion, to say that she was completely ill in some way. We don't even know how. Now we might associate demon possession with sort of mental illness, but it wasn't necessarily the case back then. It could have been physical illness. She could have simply recovered from some grave illness or some other dis-ease, some other thing that was afflicting her. We don't know. In fact, if you want to be very exact, we don't even know if this refers to a real thing or not. But it makes sense, because she was a very close follower, close student. The canonical stories, she's mentioned here and there, usually with a list of others, sometimes Salome, but also in the Gnostic sources, she's often mentioned with Salome, another female disciple of Christ. And other than this, they provided some funding for the movement. We don't know much. There are references to her as being the one Christ loved the most. And these are references to her being the one he loved most among his disciples, or the one he loved most among women. You know, closeness is the theme. She was very near to Christ, understood him, had a close relationship. Modern imagination, there's only one close relationship a male and a female can have, and that could lead to children. And we are going to be dealing with the influence of Da Vinci Code and the conspiracy theory books that preceded it through the whole of Gnosticism through our lifetimes, no doubt. It will fade. There's already mentions of it have faded, and it's become a bit quaint and a bit silly, and it'll become more so. But some of these notions have kind of settled in. And one can now basically look at recent developments of modern Gnosticism and kind of divide it, pre-code, post-code. That in the last few years there have been dozens of Gnostic churches declaring themselves in existence, most of which have, at best, really tenuous links to any previous existing tradition. A lot of them are very proud that they don't have any links. And a lot of these people found out about Gnosticism through the attacks upon the Da Vinci Code, which unrealistically and dishonestly compared it to Gnosticism, or linked it to Gnosticism. And this is going to be a constant theme. But if we try to look at this figure of Mary more deeply, see that, you know, if that is something that we hang on her, you know, like clothe her with, veil her with, that's our doing to make her the wife or the lover in the physical sense of Christ, mother of Christ's children. If we hang that upon her, that is our doing. And there is nothing out there, really, that would indicate that. Same is true with the earlier image that we hung on Mary Magdalene, that we veiled her with. This was done by, actually, no, at least who first preached on it and was written down and kept, was Pope Gregory. And this was preaching on Mary of Magdalene as being the harlot. The text really says a sinful woman, which could have meant any number of things, including if we were Roman Catholics, that she ate meat on Friday or something. I mean, this was a very broad term, but a certain type of imagination, not unlike the kind that makes her into Jesus' lover, would make her into a harlot, make her into a sex worker. In the ancient world, it's one of the few ways one could be self-employed and be a woman. It's a possibility, but it's no more founded in anything we can find out than any other thing. So she remains a mysterious figure. And in fact, that linkage merely comes from the stories following each other. The story Mary Magdalene is mentioned, and then an unnamed sinful woman is mentioned. But that is the image of Mary for centuries, for 800 years, 900 years. Still the image for many people today. And it's put up there as a block, as a veil, as a way for us to not really see who the real Mary was. But it's also a metaphor, a very beautiful metaphor, if we can disassociate the identity elements. Because we have in this story Christ being Christ, which is being a person who disregarded what one is supposed to do in every situation, what the social mores would have one do, and instead acted genuinely and saw the heart of things. And for Christ, this woman being a sinful woman, and him in the story knowing all of this, made no difference. And indeed, he offers complete forgiveness because she loved much, because this was done with love. Our way of looking at sin, it's kind of like the Holy Accountant book opened up, and you get tally marks for doing this and doing that, and then you might get forgiven for one or two of these. You know, general amnesty is just out of the picture, right? The accountant will go, what? I've got this whole itemized bill this person needs to spend in hell or purgatory when we had a purgatory. You can't just throw away and burn this account, you know? You can't burn this bill, rip it up. And a part of human nature really wants that kind of revenge to have. Well, you did bad. You get a burn in hell. And really realizing that they've done bad, and if the same rules apply, then you're all in trouble. Which is why they like to have an escape clause, a get-out-of-hell-free card. If you just believe in a sacrifice made by Christ, then you get out of hell. You get to go to heaven. How convenient that is. And well, up in heaven, you can walk down and share in the joy of watching everybody else suffer. How lovely. I'd rather be somewhere else, certainly. So in that view of things, it doesn't make sense. You have to hold these people to account. It's the current conservative view of much of this nation and much of the world with its shift towards fundamentalism. You need to stone these people. You need to have them suffer now, before our eyes, at our hands, if possible, to give us satisfaction. And also have the idea that they'll be suffering for eternity. Because apparently that's what we get the most joy of, at least as that kind of mindset stuck in the sense of revenge. Revenge fantasies. Yet this has never been what Christ has ever been about. It tells many stories in which all this stuff is pointless, meaningless, and silly. That to this day our more orthodox brothers and sisters really have no explanation for, like the workers in the field that come. And the ones who come, the last work for just 30 minutes, get paid the same as the people been there all day. It's really annoying for people. But that's the way the divine works, not the way the human works. Another way for us to get caught up in the way the human works is spend a whole lot of time worrying about gender. Well, it's really important as biological beings, and that really influences the whole of our lives. It influences even how we look at the world, how we understand things. We're biological creatures here. In the classical view of the human being, there was the body, the soul, and the spirit. Body, biology, evolution, the way we are as physical beings. Spirit, something beyond all of this. It transcends all of this. And soul has always been this meeting between the two, this mingling between the two. And that's what we think of as the psyche, as in psychology, as being who we are most of the time. And we can either root our values in the body, or root our values in the soul, or root them in the spirit. This is the classical threefold division of humanity by Gnostics. So people who put their values in the body, then they want to make sure that their creature comforts are taken care of, that they propagate, have kids, and the usual American dream, those who have their values in the soul, they seek the things of the mind, the things of beauty, that which really fills our souls, it satisfies us emotionally, it gives us intellectual joy. And those who put their values in the spirit seek that which transcends all of these forms, and which you can find mirrored, reflected, and hidden through all these forms, but it's still seeking what is beyond all of them. And these are the ways of looking at Mary Magdala as well. We look at biologically, as a harlot, or as a mother. And we're in this kind of classical dichotomy that psychologists have been able to identify as the whore-mother dichotomy. You're either one or the other. You can't be just a person. As a biological being, you're either reserved for particular reproduction or it could be anybody. But if we dismiss that the way Gnostics always have done, move a bit higher, let's see her as being a disciple, student of a teacher, obtaining this insight, this understanding, listening. But that isn't a place where Gnostics like to focus either, because the real importance of Mary Magdala is in the spirit. She was a Gnostic. When she was there, sacrificed to death, the execution of Jesus, something tradition has always affirmed that she witnessed personally. And also, though there are different variations of the story, she went to take care of the body as soon as it was possible to do so. And tradition also affirms that when she went to do that, something mysterious happened. She did not see with her normal eyes, with a normal physical Christ, because she didn't recognize this figure right away. It took an interaction for that gnosis to happen. And we can see this as being an insistence by many people over the course of the tradition that this all be physical, that this all be rooted in the physical, rooted in the biological, that our values are there. So that the meaning of Christianity is, you got a body, body breaks, body dies, magic happens, body comes back. Or if you have to take a more nuanced view, then it's more about the soul. There's a place for the soul. There's food for the soul, consolation for the soul. And the soul doesn't quite die, but in twinkling an eye is transposed to somewhere else. But at the level of the spiritual, it's much more complicated and simple. Complicated in that all the rest of that is transcended. And they're simple in that the whole thing is about transcendence, about finding that which goes beyond the current situation and links one to the eternal. And Mary of Magdala, from all that the tradition says, all the filters and colorations have been attributed to her, all these veils have been placed over her, found that transcendent experience of Christ after the death of Jesus. And she was the one who informed the other disciples of this, in a sense that showed them the way to maintain this transcendent connection, the spiritual connection, spiritual presence of Christ. She is I believe, the founder of our tradition, the founder of Christianity in that way. For as long as Jesus was teaching and around, as much as he could embody the divine, there's really no, shall we say, no incentive to try to find some way of encountering this in another way. There is someone who can guide you directly. You don't need this more subtle view. It's only when that individual is lost that you really need that connection, that spiritual connection, because the spiritual doesn't rely upon the physical or even the psychological. It's beyond all of that. And it was Mary of Magdala who made that first realization, that first deep connection, who had that gnosis of the presence of Christ, and who then made that known. She was called Apostola Apostolorum, as somewhat later sources, the Apostle of the Apostles. Apostle just means somebody who was sent. And the title Apostle to the Apostles means she was sent to go to the other apostles, so that they could have this experience of Christ and be sent themselves out into the world to teach others this way, this means, this connection. As long as there was a physical being, physical embodiment of Christ, then this movement was really kind of limited in that way. there was a teacher, the master, the one who showed them, who helped them transform themselves and was a part of that. But it could only go so far. But with the death of that figure, this physical death, this transformation beyond the level of the physical and the biological, and the movement could go throughout the world. And this is what the apostles were sent out to convey, this experience and understanding they achieved of the presence of Christ within them, out into the world. And the first one who sent, the one who sent them, essentially, was Mary of Magdala. In our world, there tend to be these larger stories, these meta-myths, if you will, that reflect what we are struggling with as a society at a given moment, at a given time. And even, of course, as individuals, there are stories that we attach to that have a strong resonance for us at certain points in our lives. You know, children who have a favorite book, it will be need to be reread to them over and 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 over again ad nauseum. And now that there are, of course, videos and so forth, you can just put it on replay and let them watch the same thing about 20 or 30 times, whatever. But that's because that story has a pattern in that story, has a particular resonance, it has a meaning, it is doing a work of transformation. It is providing a psychological container for transformation. And in our world today, we have only recently and are still not, who knows how many centuries it will take to fully transform, our notions about gender, notions about the physical, such things as race. You know, that our values being on these physical differences, our values being stuck in the physical, in the heletic, as the ancient Gnostics would have said, have led us to be more nasty to each other for a longer period of time. And we're becoming aware, to some extent, as an entire culture. And that's changing. We can, of course, look forward to a few generations down the road when this will be much reduced. And we are, of course, reaping benefits of much work done in the end of the 20th century, first part of the 20th century. Lest we forget, women's right to vote didn't occur until into the 20th century. It was really this late coming thing. And that this difference, biological gender, made such an important aspect of everyone's life. It still does. But we no longer think that women aren't able to vote, aren't able to be church leaders for the most part, though there are still many places where this isn't possible. But it's kind of this wave. There's a splash, and the wave ripples forth. So a lot of these stories take form with such figures as Mary Magdala. And to see change in that image in the culture is to see a change in the culture. So that these stories of Mary Magdala as the wife and mother is reflection, hopefully, of a positive change within the culture. The only mistake is if we, in wanting such a change, and unconsciously seeing the story, mistake that for the ultimate end truth. These figures are a part of our myths. And those myths, those stories, can be told in many different ways. And in the end, a lot of these we don't know a whole lot about, like Mary of Magdala. No, she was important. She was close to the Lord. We know that she preferred some funds, probably. She was ill and healed, probably. That's all we know. So when we see these different stories sort of drape over, use the figure of Mary of Magdala, we can look, instead of at the veiling of that figure, the obscuring of the true importance of the first apostle, as reflecting, hopefully, a positive change in the culture. A wave of something has been happening. These transformations in a culture take different forms. First, they might need to be very extreme, like in the case of the goddess movement, where you completely destroy the current framework of things and you create another one. This is what was done, many people in the late 50s through the 70s, trying to form a mythology based around the goddess, and to try to link this back into our ancient history. And this form of the story, there really wasn't any god except for this tiny little figure next to the gods. And then, as things kind of progress and move on, we have currently a bit more of a dualistic system in that thread, in that myth. So that there is some sort of attempt at a balance between a god and a goddess. This is still a myth, still working out of a mythological system. And it is that aspect of the myth, and some echoes of the previous ones that have been put upon Mary of Magdala, may have resonance for us. We need to see them as myths, not as mere myths, not as mere lies, but as really reflecting something that is going on in our world today. And as that is something to pay attention to. So we must hold on to our Gnostic first apostle and the great importance she has for us. Take on board that she is going to be used and has been used as a mythological character to express these larger social psychological transformations. And that for us will always be a part of her character as well. We encountered her through these different forms first. And then we can celebrate all of these many aspects. Because the divine, the holy, is big enough for all of these things to coexist. So may we, with our understanding and relationship to Mary, bring together these different stories, these different courageous tales. Remember always, she is our mother figure, as in Gnostic tradition. She is our paragon, as a disciple to the Lord, to be able to find Christ no matter what. Stay with Christ. Stay with that transcendent element. May we forevermore follow the apostle of the apostles. In the mystery of that which hangs betwixt heaven and earth, and upon us, may with his heart. For information and resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG. And the Gnosis Institute at gnosisinstitute.org. If you'd like to continue receiving these podcasts, please consider a voluntary subscription of either $13 or $25 a year. That's $1 to $2 a month to make it possible to continue to provide this service. Thank you.